The mere act of understanding someone else's story doesn't require you to give up your own. The and stance allows you to recognize that how you each see things matters, that how you each feel matters. Regardless of what you end up doing, regardless of whether your story influences theirs or theirs influences yours, both stories matter. The and stance is based on the assumption that the world is complex. It's a world in which you can feel hurt, angry, and wronged, and they can feel just as hurt, angry, and wronged. They can be doing their best, and you can think that it's not good enough. You may have done something stupid, and they will have contributed in important ways to the problem as well. You can feel furious with them, and you can also feel love and appreciation for them. It may be that as you share them, your stories may change in response to new information or different perspectives. But they still may not end up the same, and that's all right. Sometimes people have honest disagreements. But even so, the most useful question is not who's right, but now that we really understand each other, what's a good way to manage this problem? You may be thinking that the advice to shift from certainty and arguing to curiosity and the and stance generally makes sense, but that there must be exceptions. Let's look at two important questions that may look like exceptions but aren't. What about times when I absolutely know I'm right? And does the suggestion to understand the other person's story always apply, even when, for example, I'm firing someone or breaking up with them? For example, what about the conversation you have with your daughter about her smoking? You know you were right that smoking is bad for her, that the sooner she stops, the better. Fair enough. About each of those things, you are right. But here's the rub. That's not what the conversation is really about. It's really about how you each feel about your daughter smoking, what she should do about it, and what role you should play in that. It's about the terrible fear and sadness you feel as you imagine her becoming sick, and your rage at feeling powerless to make her stop. It's about her need to feel independent, to break out of the good girl mold that feels so suffocating. It's about her own ambivalence, doing something that makes her feel good and at the same time truly frightens her. The conversation is about many issues between the two of you that are complex and important to explore. It is not about the truth of whether smoking is bad for one's health. Both of you already agree on that. So even when it seems the dispute is about what's true, you may find that being the one who's right doesn't get you very far. And what if you have to fire someone or end a relationship? In many difficult conversations, you don't have the power to impose an outcome unilaterally. When firing someone or breaking up, you do. In such situations, it's reasonable to wonder whether the other person's story is still relevant. Most of the difficulty in firing someone or in breaking up takes place in the feelings and identity conversations, which we'll explore later. But the question of differing perspectives is also important. Remember, understanding the other person's story doesn't mean you have to agree with it, nor does it require you to give up your own story. And the fact that you're willing to try to understand their view doesn't diminish the power you have to implement your decision and to be clear that your decision is final. In fact, the and stance is probably the most powerful place you can stand when engaging in a difficult conversation that requires you to deliver or enforce bad news. If you were breaking up with someone, it allows you to say, "I'm breaking up with you because it's the right thing for me. Here's why. And I understand how hurt you are, and that you think we should try again. And I'm not changing my mind, and I understand that you think I should have been more clear about my confusion earlier. And I don't think that makes me a bad person. And I understand that I've done things that have hurt you. And I know you've done things that have hurt me. And I know I might regret this decision. And I'm still making it. And. And helps you to be curious and clear. As you head down the path of improving how you deal with difficult conversations, you will notice that the question of how we each make sense of our worlds follows you like the moon in the night sky. It's a beacon you can return to, no matter where you are or what difficult problem you are grappling with. Coming to understand them and yourself more deeply doesn't mean that differences will disappear or that you won't have to solve real problems and make real choices. It doesn't mean that all views are equally valid, or that it's wrong to have strongly held beliefs. It will, however, help you evaluate whether your strong views make sense in light of new information and different interpretations, and it will help you help others to appreciate the power of your views. Wherever you want to go, understanding, imagining yourself in the other person's story, has got to be your first step. Before you can figure out how to move forward, you need to understand where you are. Next, we want to delve more deeply into two problematic aspects of our story: our tendency to misunderstand other people's intentions, and our tendency to focus on blame.
Don't assume they meant it. Disentangle intent from impact. The question of who intended what is central to our story about what's happening in a difficult situation. Intentions strongly influence our judgments of others. If they intended to hurt us, we judge them more harshly than if they hurt us by mistake. We're willing to be inconvenienced by someone if they have a good reason. We're irritated if we think they just don't care about the impact of their actions on us. Though either blocks our way just as surely, we react differently to an ambulance double parked on a narrow street than to a BMW in front of the video store. Consider the story of Lori and Leo, who have been in a relationship for 2 years and have a recurring fight that is painful to both of them. The couple was at a party thrown by some friends, and Lori was about to reach for another scoop of ice cream when Leo said, "Lori, why don't you lay off the ice cream?" Lori, who struggles with her weight, shot Leo a nasty look, and the two avoided each other for a while. Later that evening, things went from bad to worse.
"I really resented it at the party, the way you treated me in front of our friends."
"The way I treated you? What are you talking about?"
"About the ice cream. You act like you're my father or something. You have this need to control me or put me down."
"Lori, I wasn't trying to hurt you. You said you were on a diet. I'm just trying to help you stick to it. You're so defensive. You hear everything as an attack on you, even when I'm just trying to help."
"Help? Humiliating me in front of my friends is your idea of helping?"
"You know, I just can't win with you. If I say something, you think I'm trying to humiliate you. If I don't, you ask me why I let you overeat. I'm just sick of this. Sometimes I wonder whether you just start these fights on purpose."
This conversation left both Leo and Lori feeling angry, hurt, and misunderstood. They are engaged in a classic battle over intentions. Lori accuses Leo of hurting her on purpose, and Leo denies it. They're caught in a cycle they don't understand and don't know how to break. But there is a way out. Two crucial mistakes in this conversation make it infinitely more difficult than it needs to be, one by Lori and one by Leo. When Lori says, "You have this need to control me or put me down," she is talking about Leo's intentions. Her mistake is to assume she knows what Leo's intentions are, when in fact she doesn't. It's an easy and debilitating mistake to make, and we do it all the time. Leo's mistake is to assume that once he clarifies that his intentions were good, Lori is no longer justified in being upset. He explains that he wasn't trying to hurt Lori. In fact, he was trying to help. And having explained this, Leo thinks that should be the end of it. As a result, he doesn't take the time to learn what Lori is really feeling, or why. This mistake, too, is as common as it is crippling. Exploring Lori's mistake requires us to understand how our minds work when devising stories about what others intend, and to learn to recognize the set of questionable assumptions upon which these stories are built. Here's the problem. While we care deeply about other people's intentions toward us, we don't actually know what their intentions are. We can't. Other people's intentions exist only in their hearts and minds. However real and right our assumptions about other people's intentions may seem to us, they are often incomplete or just plain wrong. Much of this first mistake can be traced to one basic error. We make an attribution about another person's intentions based on the impact of their actions on us. We feel hurt, therefore they intended to hurt us. We feel slighted, therefore they intended to slight us. Our thinking is so automatic that we aren't even aware that our conclusion is only an assumption. And we assume the worst. When a friend shows up late to the movie, we don't think, gee, I bet he ran into someone in need. More likely, we think, that jerk, he doesn't care about making me miss the beginning of the movie. When we've been hurt by someone else's behavior, we assume the worst. Margaret fell into this pattern. She had her hip operated on by a prominent surgeon, a man she found gruff and hard to talk to. When Margaret hobbled in for her first appointment after surgery, the receptionist told her that the doctor had unexpectedly extended his vacation. Angry, Margaret imagined her wealthy doctor cavorting in the Caribbean with his wife or girlfriend, too self-important and inconsiderate to return on schedule. The picture compounded her anger. When Margaret finally saw the doctor a week later, she asked curtly how his vacation had been, and he responded that it had been wonderful. "I'll bet," she said, wondering whether to raise her concerns. But the doctor went on. "It was a working vacation. I was helping to set up a hospital in Bosnia. The conditions there are just horrendous." Learning what the doctor was really doing didn't erase the inconvenience Margaret had endured. Yet knowing that he was not acting out of selfishness, but from an unrelated and actually quite generous motivation, left Margaret feeling substantially better about having to wait the extra week. What's ironic, and all too human, about our tendency to attribute bad intentions to others is how differently we treat ourselves. When your husband forgets to pick up the dry cleaning, he's irresponsible. When you forget to book the airline tickets, it's because you're overworked and stressed out. When a coworker criticizes your work in front of department colleagues, she's obviously trying to put you down. When you offer suggestions to others in the same meeting, you're trying to be helpful. When we're the one acting, we know that much of the time we don't intend to annoy, offend, or upstage others. We're wrapped up in our own worries and are often unaware that we're having any negative impact on others. When we're the ones acted upon, however, our story too easily slides into one about bad intentions and bad character. Are there never bad intentions? Of course, sometimes we do get hurt because someone meant to hurt us. The person we are dealing with is nasty or inconsiderate, out to make us look bad or steal our best friend. But these situations are rarer than we imagine. And without hearing from the other person, we can't really know his or her intentions. Perhaps the biggest danger of assuming the other person had bad intentions is that we easily jump from, they had bad intentions, to, they're just a bad person. We settle into judgments about their character that color our view of them, and indeed affect not only any conversation we might have, but the entire relationship. Once we think we have someone figured out, we see all of their actions through that lens. Even if we don't share our view with them, the impact remains. The worse our view of the other person's character, the easier it is to justify avoiding them or saying nasty things behind their back. Our assumption about other people's intentions can also have a significant impact on our conversations. The easiest and most common way of expressing these assumptions is with an accusatory question. How come you wanted to hurt me? Why do you ignore me like this? What have I done that makes you feel it's okay to step all over me? We think we are sharing our hurt, frustration, anger, or confusion. We're trying to begin a conversation that will end in greater understanding, perhaps some improved behavior, maybe an apology. What they think we are doing is trying to provoke, accuse, or malign them. In other words, they make the same mistaken leap in judging our intentions. And given how frequently our assumptions are incomplete or wrong, the other person often feels not just accused, but falsely accused. We should not be surprised, then, that they try to defend themselves or attack back. From their point of view, they're defending themselves from false accusations. We think they're just being defensive. We're right, they just aren't big enough to admit it. The result is a mess. No one learns anything, no one apologizes, nothing changes. Lori and Leo fall right into this. Leo is defensive throughout, and at the end, when he says he sometimes wonders if Lori starts these fights on purpose, he actually accuses Lori of bad intentions. and thus begins a cycle of accusation. If interviewed about their conversation afterwards, both Lori and Leo would report that they were the victim of the other's bad intentions. Each would claim that their own statements were made in self-defense. Those are the two classic characterizations of the cycle. Both parties think they are the victim, and both think they are acting only to defend themselves. This is how well-intentioned people get themselves into trouble. These attributions can become self-fulfilling. Our assumptions about other people's intentions often come true, even when they aren't true to begin with. You think your boss isn't giving you enough responsibility. You assume that this is because she doesn't trust you to do the work well. You feel demotivated by this state of affairs, figuring that nothing you do will change your boss's mind. Your work suffers, and your boss, who actually hadn't been concerned about your work before, is now quite worried. So she gives you even less responsibility than before. As we've seen, the mistake Lori makes in assuming she knows Leo's intentions, although seemingly small, has big consequences. Now let's come back to Leo, who makes an equally costly error in the conversation. He assumes that because he had good intentions, Lori should not feel hurt. The thinking goes like this. You said I meant to hurt you. I have now clarified that I didn't. So you should now feel fine, and if you don't, that's your problem. The problem with focusing only on clarifying our intentions is that we end up missing significant pieces of what the other person is trying to say. When they say, "Why were you trying to hurt me?" they are really communicating two separate messages. First, I know what you intended, and second, I got hurt. When we are the person accused, we focus only on the first message and ignore the second. Why? Because we feel the need to defend ourselves. Because Leo is so busy defending himself, he fails to hear that Lori is hurt. He doesn't take in what this all means to her, how hurt she is, or why these issues are so painful. Working to understand what the other person is really saying is particularly important because when someone says, "You intended to hurt me," that isn't quite what they mean. A literal focus on intentions ends up clouding the conversation. Often we say, "You intended to hurt me," when what we really mean is, "You don't care enough about me." This is an important distinction. The father who is too busy at work to attend his son's basketball game doesn't intend to hurt his son. He would prefer not to hurt his son. But his desire not to hurt his son is not as strong as his desire or need to work. Most of us on the receiving end make little distinction between, "He wanted to hurt me," and, "He didn't want to hurt me, but he didn't make me a priority." Either way, it hurts. If the father responds to his son's complaint by saying, "I didn't intend to hurt you," he's not addressing his son's real concern. "You may not have intended to hurt me, but you knew you were hurting me, and you did it anyway." Another problem with assuming that good intentions sanitize a negative impact is that intentions are often more complex than just good or bad. Are Leo's intentions purely angelic? Is he just trying to help Lori with her diet? Perhaps he himself is embarrassed by Lori's tendency to overeat, and he felt compelled to say something. Or maybe he wants her to lose weight, not so much for herself, but for him. If he really cares about her, as he says he does, shouldn't he be more aware of how his words affect her? As is so often the case in such situations, Leo's intentions are probably mixed. He may or may not even be fully aware of what is actually motivating him. But the answer to the question of what is truly motivating Leo is less important than his willingness to ask the question and look for an answer. If his first response to Lori is, "I had good intentions," then he is putting up a barrier to any learning he might get from the conversation. And he is sending a message to Lori that says, "Look, I'm more interested in defending myself than I am in investigating the complexities of what might be going on for me in our relationship." Interestingly, when people take on the job of thinking hard about their own intentions, it sends a profoundly positive message to the other person about the importance of the relationship. After all, you'd only do that kind of hard work for someone who mattered to you. So how can Lori avoid the mistake of attributing intentions to Leo that he might not have? Her first step is simply to recognize that there is a difference between the impact of Leo's behavior on her and what Leo intended. She can't get anywhere without disentangling the two. Separating impact from intentions requires us to be aware of the automatic leap from "I was hurt" to "you intended to hurt me." You can do this by asking yourself three questions. What did the other person actually say or do? Second, what was the impact of this on me? And finally, based on this impact, what assumption am I making about what the other person intended? Once you have clearly answered these three questions, the next step is to make absolutely certain that you recognize that your assumption about their intentions is just an assumption. It's a guess, a hypothesis. Then use the answers to these three questions to begin the difficult conversation itself. Say what the other person did, tell them what its impact was on you, and explain your assumption about their intentions, taking care to label it as a hypothesis that you are checking, rather than asserting it to be true. Consider how this would change the beginning of the conversation between Lori and Leo. Instead of beginning with an accusation, Lori can begin by identifying what Leo said and what the impact was on her.
You know when you said, "Why don't you lay off the ice cream?" Well, I felt hurt by that.
You did?
Yeah.
I was just trying to help you stay on your diet. Why would that make you upset?
I felt embarrassed that you said it in front of our friends. Then what I wonder is whether you said it on purpose to embarrass or hurt me. I don't know why you'd want to do that, but that's what I'm thinking when it happens.
Well, Lori, I'm certainly not doing it on purpose. I guess I just didn't realize it was that upsetting. You know, I'm a little bit confused about what you want me to say if I actually see you going off your diet.
The conversation is only beginning, but it's certainly off to a better start. Of course, no matter how skillfully you handle things, some defensiveness is inevitable. The matter of intentions and impacts is complex, and sometimes the distinctions are fine. So it's best to anticipate a certain amount of defensiveness and to be prepared to clarify what you are trying to communicate and what you are not. The more you can relieve the other person of the need to defend themselves, the easier it becomes for them to take in what you are saying and to reflect on the complexity of their own motivations. For example, you might say, "You know, I was surprised you made that comment. It seemed uncharacteristic of you." Assuming this is true, that it is uncharacteristic, you are giving some balance to the information you are bringing to their attention. If there was some malice mixed in with what they said, this balance makes it easier for them to own up to it. And remember that the accusation about bad intentions is always made up of two separate ideas. First, we had bad intentions. And second, the other person was frustrated, hurt, or embarrassed. Don't pretend they aren't saying the first. You'll want to respond to it. But neither should you ignore the second. If you start by listening and acknowledging the feelings, then return to the question of intentions, it will make your conversation significantly easier and more constructive. When it comes time to consider your intentions, try to avoid the tendency to say, "My intentions were pure." We usually think this about ourselves, and sometimes it's true, but often, as we've seen, intentions are more complex. We may imagine that if we admit to having mixed or negative intentions, the other person will think us evil. In many cases, however, the opposite is true. They appreciate the honesty and will hear a powerful implicit message. I care enough about this relationship to take a good, hard look at myself. It's painful, but the relationship, you, are worth it. We can imagine how the initial conversation might have gone if Leo followed this advice with Lori.
"I really resented it at the party, the way you treated me in front of our friends."
"The way I treated you? What do you mean?"
"About the ice cream. You act like you're my father or something. You have this need to control me or put me down."
"Wow, it sounds like what I said really ended up hurting you."
"Of course it hurt. What did you expect?"
"Well, at the time, I was thinking you said you wanted to be on your diet, and I was trying to figure out a way to help you stick to it. But I guess I could see how saying something in front of everyone would be pretty embarrassing. I don't know why I didn't see that at the time."
"Maybe you were embarrassed to have to say something."
"Yeah, maybe. I guess I was thinking you seemed a little out of control, which is sort of a big issue for me."
"That's true. And I probably was a little out of control."
"Anyway, Lori, look, I'm really sorry. I hate hurting you, and Let's just think about what I should do next time if we get into a situation like this.
Okay.
Understanding how we distort others' intentions, making difficult conversations even more difficult, is crucial to untangling what happened between us. However, there is still one more piece to the what happened conversation that can get us into trouble. The question of who is to blame.
Abandon blame. Map the contribution system. The ad agency you work for flies you to Boulder to pitch executives at Extreme Sport, a burgeoning sportswear company and a potentially important client. You turn to begin your presentation, only to discover that you've got the wrong storyboards. Right client, wrong campaign. Shaken, you stumble through an unfocused talk. With one slip, your assistant, who packs your briefcase, has undermined weeks of hard work. You blame your assistant, not just because he's a convenient target for your frustration, or because letting others know it was he and not you who screwed up may help salvage your reputation, but because it is the simple truth. This was his fault. When you and your assistant finally discuss what went wrong, you can take one of two approaches. You can blame him explicitly, saying something like, "I don't know how you could have let this happen." Or, if you tend to be less confrontational, or have been taught that blaming people isn't helpful, you can blame him implicitly with something less threatening, like, "Let's do better next time." Either way, he'll get the message. He's to blame. Blame is a prominent issue in many difficult conversations. Whether on the surface or below, the conversation revolves around the question of who is to blame. Who is the bad person in this relationship? Who made the mistake? Who should apologize? Who gets to be righteously indignant? Focusing on blame is a bad idea. Not because it's hard to talk about, nor because it can injure relationships and cause pain and anxiety. Focusing on blame is a bad idea because it inhibits our ability to learn what's really causing the problem and to do anything meaningful to correct it. And because blame is often irrelevant and unfair. The urge to blame is based, quite literally, on a misunderstanding of what has given rise to the issues between you and the other person, and on the fear of being blamed. Too often, blaming also serves as a bad proxy for talking directly about hurt feelings. But the advice, "don't blame others," is not very helpful. You can't move away from blame until you understand what blame is, what motivates us to want to blame each other, and how to move toward something else that will better serve our purposes in difficult conversations. That something else is the concept of contribution. The distinction between blame and contribution is not always easy to grasp, but it is essential to improving your ability to handle difficult conversations well. At heart, blame is about judging, and contribution is about understanding. When we ask the question, "Who is to blame?" we are really asking three questions in one. First, did this person cause the problem? Did your assistant's actions or inactions cause you to have the wrong storyboards? Second, if so, how should his actions be judged against some standard of conduct? Was he incompetent, unreasonable, or unethical? And third, if the judgment is negative, how should he be punished? Will he be yelled at, warned, perhaps even fired? When we say this was your fault, it is shorthand for giving condemning answers to all three questions. We mean not only that you caused this, but that you did something bad and should be punished. It's no wonder that blame is such a loaded issue, and that we are quick to defend ourselves when we sense its approach. When blame is in play, you can expect defensiveness, strong emotion, interruptions, and arguments about what good assistants, loving spouses, or any reasonable person should or shouldn't do. When we blame someone, we are offering them the role of the accused. So they do what accused people do. They defend themselves any way they can. Contribution asks a related but different set of questions. The first question is, how did we each contribute to bringing about the current situation? Or, put another way, what did we each do or not do to get ourselves into this mess? The second question is, Having identified the contribution system, how can we change it? What can we do about it as we go forward? To illustrate, let's return to the extreme sports story and imagine two contrasting conversations between you and your assistant. The first conversation focuses on blame, the second on contribution.
I wanted to talk to you about my presentation at Extreme Sport. You packed the wrong storyboards. It was unbelievably awkward. It made me look terrible. We simply cannot work this way.
I heard. I'm so sorry. You probably don't want to hear my excuses.
I just don't understand how you could let this happen.
I'm really sorry.
I know you didn't do it on purpose, and I know you feel bad. But I don't want this to happen again. You understand what I'm saying?
It absolutely won't. I promise.
All three elements of blame are present. You caused this, I'm judging you negatively, and implicit in what I am saying is that one way or another, you will be punished, especially if it happens again. In contrast, a conversation about contribution might sound like this.
I wanted to talk to you about my presentation at Extreme Sport. When I arrived, I found the wrong storyboards in my briefcase.
I heard. I'm so sorry. I feel terrible.
I appreciate that. I'm feeling pretty bad, too. Let's retrace our steps and think about how this happened. I suspect we may each have contributed to the problem. Now, from your point of view, did I do anything differently this time?
I'm not sure. I mean, we were working on three accounts at once, and on the one just before this, when I asked you which storyboards you wanted packed, you got kind of angry. And I know it's my responsibility to know which ones you want, but sometimes when things get hectic, it just gets really confusing.
Look, if you're unsure, you should always ask. But it sounds like you're saying I don't always make it easy to do that. Is that right?
Well, I do get intimidated sometimes. When you get really busy, it's like you don't want to be bothered. The day you left, you were in that kind of mood. I was trying to stay out of your way because I didn't want to add to your frustration. I planned to double-check which storyboard you wanted when you got off the phone, but then I had to run to the copy center. After you left, I remembered, but I know you also usually double-check your briefcase, so I just figured it was okay that way.
Yeah, I do usually double-check, but this time I was so overwhelmed I forgot. I think we probably both better double-check every time. And I do get in those moods. I know it can be hard to interact with me when I'm like that. I need to work on being less impatient and abrupt. But if you're unsure, I need you to ask questions, no matter what kind of mood I'm in.
So you want me to ask questions even if I think it'll annoy you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll try to be less irritable. But can you do that?
Well, talking about it this way makes it a lot easier. I realize it's important.
Look, you can even refer to this conversation. You can say, hey, I know you're under pressure, but you made me promise I'd do this. Or just say, hey, you promised not to be such a jerk.
Okay, that works for me.
We might also think about how you could track better which appointments are going to be for which campaigns.
In this second conversation, you and your assistant have begun to identify the contributions that you each brought to the problem, and the ways in which each of your reactions are part of an overall pattern. You feel anxious and distracted about an upcoming presentation, and you snap at your assistant. He assumes that you want him out of the way, and withdraws. Something falls through the cracks. And then you were even more annoyed and worried the next time you were preparing, since you're no longer sure you can trust your assistant to help you. So you become more abrupt, increasingly unapproachable, and the communication between you continues to erode. Mistakes multiply. As you get a handle on the interactive system the two of you have created, you can see what you each need to do to avoid or alter that system in the future. As a result, this second conversation is more likely than the first to produce lasting change in the way you work together. Focusing on the contributions of both the assistant and the boss, seeking understanding rather than judgment, is critical. This is not just good practice. It accords more closely with reality. As a rule, when things go wrong in human relationships, everyone has contributed in some important way. A contribution system is present. And that system includes input from both people. Other than in extreme cases, such as child abuse, virtually every situation that gives rise to such a conversation is the result of a joint contribution system. Focusing on only one or the other of the contributors obscures rather than illuminates that system. When the tub overflows and ruins the living room ceiling down below, should we blame the forgetful bather The spouse who called the bather downstairs? The manufacturer who designed an overflow drain that is too small? The plumber who failed to mention it? The answer to who contributed to the problem is all of the above. When your real goal is fixing the ceiling and preventing the incident in the future, focusing on blame is a waste of time. It neither helps you understand the problem looking back, nor helps you fix it going forward. Fundamentally, using the blame frame makes conversations more difficult, while understanding the contribution system makes a difficult conversation easier and more likely to be productive. Imagine a couple confronting a wife's infidelity. Accusations fly as the questions of blame are confronted. After much anguish, the husband chooses to stay in the marriage under the condition that such infidelity never happen again. There is an apparent resolution, but what has each person really learned from the experience? As one-sided as an affair may seem, it often involves some contribution from both partners. Unless these contributions are sorted out, the problems and patterns in the marriage that gave rise to the affair will continue to cause difficulty. Some questions need to be asked. Does the husband listen to his wife? Does he stay at work late? Was his wife feeling sad, lonely, undesirable? If so, why? And to understand the system, the couple then needs to follow up with more questions. If the husband doesn't listen to his wife, what's she doing to contribute to that? What does she say or do that encourages him to shut down or withdraw? Does she work every weekend or withdraw when she's feeling upset? How does their relationship work? If the factors that contributed to the infidelity are to be understood and addressed, these questions must be explored. The contribution system must be mapped. There are three common misunderstandings that can keep people from fully embracing and benefiting from the concept of contribution. The first misconception is thinking that you should focus only on your contribution. Advice that you should search for joint contribution to a problem is sometimes heard as, you should overlook the other person's contribution and focus only on your own. This is a mistake. Finding your contribution doesn't in any way negate the other person's contribution. It has taken both of you to get into this mess. It will probably take both of you to get out. Recognizing that everyone involved in a situation has contributed to the problem doesn't mean that everyone has contributed equally. You can be 5% responsible or 95% responsible. There is still joint contribution. Of course, quantifying contribution is not easy, and in most cases, not very helpful. Understanding is the goal, not assigning percentages. The second misconception is thinking that putting aside blame means putting aside feelings. Quite the contrary. As you and the other person look at how you have each contributed to the problem, sharing your feelings is essential. Indeed, the very impulse to blame is often stimulated by strong emotions that lie unexpressed. When you learn of your wife's infidelity, you want to say, "You are responsible for ruining our marriage. How could you do something so stupid and hurtful?" Here, you are focusing on blame as a proxy for your feelings. Speaking more directly about your strong feelings, "I feel devastated by what you did," or "My ability to trust you has been shattered," actually reduces the impulse to blame. Over time, as you look ahead, it frees you to talk more comfortably and productively in terms of contribution. If you find yourself mired in a continuing urge to blame, or with an unceasing desire for the other person to admit that they were wrong, you may find some relief by asking yourself, "What feelings am I failing to express, and has the other person acknowledged my feelings?" As you explore this terrain, you may find yourself naturally shifting from a blame frame to a contribution frame. You may learn that what you really seek is understanding and acknowledgement. What you want the other person to say isn't, "It was my fault," but rather, "I understand that I hurt you, and I'm sorry." The first statement is about judgment, the second about understanding. The third misconception is thinking that exploring contribution means blaming the victim. When someone blames the victim, they are suggesting that the victim brought it on themselves, that they deserved or even wanted to be victimized. This is both terribly unfair and often very painful for the victim. Looking for joint contribution is not about blame of any kind. Imagine that you were mugged while walking down a dark street late at night. Blame asks, did you do something wrong? Did you break the law? Did you act immorally? Should you be punished? The answer to all of these questions is no. You didn't do anything wrong. You didn't deserve to be mugged. Being mugged was not your fault. Contribution asks a different set of questions. Contribution asks, what did I do that helped cause the situation? You can find contribution even in situations where you carry no blame. You did contribute to being mugged. How? By choosing to walk alone at night. If you'd been somewhere else or in a group, getting mugged would have been less likely. If we're looking to punish someone for what happened, we would punish the mugger. If we're looking to help you feel empowered in the world, we would encourage you to find your contribution. You may not be able to change other people's contributions, but you can often change your own. The concept of contribution makes sense, you may be thinking. Even so, as you reflect on your own most pressing entanglement, you were baffled. In this particular situation, I just don't see how I have any contribution. Spotting your own contribution becomes easier with practice, but it helps to be familiar with four common contributions that are often overlooked. One of the most common contributions, and one of the easiest to overlook, is the simple act of avoiding. You have allowed the problem to continue unchecked by not having addressed it earlier. It may be that your ex-husband has been late every time he's picked up your kids for the last 2 years, but you've never mentioned to him that it was a problem. It may be that your boss has trampled thoughtlessly on your self-esteem since you began work 4 years ago, but you've chosen not to share with her the impact on you. The flip side of not bringing something up is having an interpersonal style that keeps people at bay. In other words, being unapproachable. This is another common contribution to a problem. You contribute by being uninterested, unpredictable, short-tempered, judgmental, punitive, hypersensitive, argumentative, or just unfriendly. Of course, whether you are really any of these things is not the point. If someone experiences you this way, they are less likely to raise things with you, and this becomes part of the system of avoidance between you. A third contribution is what we call an intersection. Intersections result from a simple difference between two people, a difference in background, preferences, communication style, or assumptions about relationships. Consider Toby and Eng An, who have been married for about 4 months. Their fights have begun falling into a predictable pattern. Toby is usually the one to initiate a discussion about an issue. Who is doing more of the housework? Why Eng An didn't stick up for him with her mother? Whether to save or spend her year-end bonus? When things become heated, Eng An ends the discussion by saying, "Look, I just don't want to talk about this right now," and walking out. When Eng An shuts down or walks out, Toby is left feeling abandoned and also responsible for coping with the problems in their relationship on his own. He complains to friends that Eng An is incapable of dealing with feelings, hers or mine. She goes into denial when the tiniest thing is wrong. Toby becomes increasingly frustrated with their inability to make tough decisions, or simply to have it out. Meanwhile, Eng An is confiding in her sister. "Toby is smothering me. Everything is an emergency. Everything has to be discussed right now. He has no sensitivity for how I feel about whether it's a good time for me. He's constantly making these minuscule disagreements into huge problems that we've got to discuss for hours." When Toby and Eng An finally talk explicitly about what's happening, they realize that their past experiences have created an intersection of conflicting assumptions about communication and relationships. Toby's mother, it turns out, had alcohol problems that escalated over the course of his childhood. Toby was the only member of the family willing to speak up about what was happening. His father and sisters went into denial, acting as if nothing were wrong, and ignoring his mother's erratic behavior, no doubt clinging unconsciously to the hope that it would somehow get better. But it didn't. Perhaps as a result, Toby has a deep sense that raising and addressing problems immediately is crucial to the ongoing health of his relationship with Eng An. Eng An's home was quite different. Her brother is mentally handicapped, and life revolved around his schedule and needs. While Eng-An loved her brother very much, she sometimes needed a respite from the constant emotional turmoil of worry, crises, and caretaking that surrounded him. She learned not to react too quickly to a potential problem, and worked hard to create the distance she needed in an emotionally intense family. Toby's reactions to their disagreements threaten this carefully nurtured emotional space. We see how combining the two worldviews produces a system of interaction in which Toby talks and Eng-An withdraws. Operating in a blame frame, Toby concluded that their difficulties were Eng-An's fault because she was in denial and couldn't handle feelings. Eng-An decided that their difficulties were Toby's fault because he overreacts and smothers me. By shifting to a contribution frame, the couple was able to piece together elements of the system that led to their fights and talk about how to handle it. Only then did their communication improve. A fourth hard-to-spot contribution involves assumptions, often unconscious, about your role in a situation. When your assumption differs from those of others, you have an intersection, such as Toby and Eng-An's. But role assumptions can be problematic even when they are shared. The members of George's family, for example, all knew their parts in a repetitive family dynamic. 7-year-old George would do something annoying, like bang a spoon against the dog dish. Eventually, George's mother would say to her husband, "Can't you make him stop that?" Whereupon George's dad would yell, "Stop it!" George would jump and perhaps cry, and his mother would then turn back to her husband and say, "Well, you didn't have to yell at him." Dad would sigh and return to reading the paper. And after a few minutes, George would find another irritating way to get some attention, and the pattern would repeat. While no member of the family particularly enjoyed this dynamic, it did help them connect emotionally. Obviously, this form of connecting, fighting to show love, has its limitations. Yet it and many other less than ideal dynamics are surprisingly common. Why? First, because despite its problems, the familiar pattern is comfortable, and the members of the group work to keep each person playing their role. Second, because changing a contribution system requires more than just spotting it and recognizing its limitations. George and his parents need to find better ways to demonstrate affection and maintain closeness, and this is likely to require some tough work in their feelings and identity conversations. If you are still unable to see your contribution, try one of the following two approaches. First, ask yourself, what would they say I'm contributing? Pretend you are the other person, and answer the question in the first person, using pronouns like I, me, and my. Seeing yourself through someone else's eyes can help you understand what you're doing to feed the system. Second, try stepping back and looking at the problem from the perspective of a disinterested observer. Imagine that you were a consultant called in to help the people in this situation better understand why they are getting stuck. How would you describe in a neutral, non-judgmental way what each person is contributing? If you have trouble getting out of your own shoes in this way, ask a friend to try it for you. If what your friend comes up with surprises you, don't reject it immediately. Rather, imagine that it is true. Ask yourself how that could be and what it would mean if it were true. Shifting your stance away from assessing blame and toward exploring contribution doesn't happen overnight. It takes hard work and persistence. You will repeatedly find yourself and others slipping back into a blame frame, and you will need to be vigilant in constantly correcting your course. Sydney learned this while leading a team of engineers on a consulting assignment in Brazil. She was the only woman on the project and the youngest on the team by 15 years. One of the team members, Miguel, was particularly hostile to her leadership, and she set out to win him over by assigning him to work with her on a number of subcomponents of the project. The two executed several tasks together successfully, and each began to feel more comfortable with the other's style and competence. Then one evening, while working through dinner at the hotel restaurant, Miguel changed the currency of their relationship. "You were so beautiful," Miguel said to Sydney, "and we're so far away from home." He leaned across the table and stroked her hair. Uncomfortable, Sydney suggested they get back to these figures. She avoided his eyes and wrapped things up quickly. Miguel's provocative behavior continued over the next few days. He would stand close to Sydney, pay more attention to her than to other members of the team, seek her out at every opportunity. Although he never issued a direct invitation for physical involvement, Sydney wondered whether this was what he was after. Initially, like many of us, Sydney fell into a blame frame. She judged Miguel's behavior as inappropriate and felt victimized by it. But along with blame came several doubts. Just as she would get up the courage to tell Miguel his behavior was wrong, Sydney worried that she was overreacting or misinterpreting his actions. Perhaps, after all, it was just a cultural difference. Sydney also feared that accusing Miguel would take things from bad to worse. The situation is uncomfortable but manageable, she thought. If I tell Miguel his behavior is wrong, I run the risk that he will explode, disrupt the team, or do something to endanger the project. And the project is my first priority. By continuing to think in terms of blame, Sydney kept the stakes of raising the issue unmanageably high. In such a situation, what you need to do is move away from blame and reorient your thinking. You need to map the contribution system. You can begin to diagnose the system by looking for the contributions each of you have made to create the problem. Some of us are prone to focus on the other person's contribution and have a harder time seeing our own. As shifters, we tend to see ourselves as innocent victims. When something goes wrong, it's always because of what someone else did. Others of us have the opposite tendency. We are all too well aware of the negative consequences of our own actions. In the face of this, others' contributions seem insignificant. An absorber tends to feel responsible for everything. Knowing your predisposition can help you fight it, enable you to get a balanced picture of what each person is contributing. To understand a contribution system, you have to understand all its components. In the case of Sydney and Miguel, Miguel's contributions are relatively easy to identify. He is expressing romantic affection, but failing to clarify his intentions or the extent of his interest. He chooses to stand close to Sydney, to spend more time and energy talking with her than with his other colleagues, to hint at feelings of longing for her. He chooses, consciously or unconsciously, to ignore the nonverbal signals Sydney is sending. She changes the subject. She changes the staffing assignments. She moves away. He follows. He has chosen not to inquire about how she feels about what is happening. Miguel may or may not be aware of Sydney's discomfort. His actions may or may not be blameworthy, and it may or may not be appropriate to punish him. But these are separate inquiries from the question of contribution. What is important here is that these are pieces of the puzzle that come from Miguel. Sydney's contributions begin to surface once we shift out of the blame frame. She was particularly attentive to Miguel's concerns about the team and went out of her way to work with him. He may have read this as interest on her part. Sydney has avoided telling Miguel, at least directly, that she's felt at all uncomfortable. Regardless of how justified or understandable Sydney's actions are, these actions and inactions on her part contributed to their current situation. They make it easier to understand why Miguel continues to act as he does. And often there are other important contributors to the system. For example, with Toby and Eng An, their families have played an important role. In Sydney's case, other members of the team may have inadvertently encouraged Miguel or passed up opportunities to help Sydney. When exploring a contribution system, consider what other players may be contributing something important. Raising contribution during the conversation itself can be surprisingly easy. Getting the other person to shift from blame to contribution can be more difficult. One of the best ways to signal that you want to leave behind the question of who's to blame is to acknowledge your own contribution early in the conversation. For example, Sydney might say to Miguel,
I apologize for not bringing this up earlier before it became such a big deal for me. I realize that arranging for us to work together at the beginning of the project, it might have sent a confusing signal. Although all I intended was to improve our professional relationship, what was your reaction?
She might also ask, are there other things I've done that were ambiguous, or that suggested I might be interested in something else? Sydney would learn important information about her own impact, and also set the stage for a discussion of Miguel's contribution. You may fear that being the first to own up to some contribution puts you in a vulnerable position for the rest of the conversation. What if the other person remains focused on blame, is more than happy to acknowledge your contribution, and says, in effect, I agree that this is your fault, and then is adamant that they contributed nothing? This is an important concern, especially if you tend to be a contribution absorber. Acknowledging your contribution is a risk, but not acknowledging your contribution also involves risks. If Sydney starts by pointing out Miguel's contributions, Miguel is likely to become defensive and feel that the conversation is unfairly one-sided. Rather than acknowledging his contribution, Miguel may be tempted to deflect attention from it, and the easiest way to do that is to point out Sydney's part in the problem. Taking responsibility for your contribution up front prevents the other person from using it as a shield to avoid a discussion of their own contribution. If you feel the focus is somehow on you alone, you can say so. It's not okay to look only at my contribution. That's not reality as I see it. I feel like I'm trying to look at both of us. Is there anything I'm doing to make it hard for you to look at yourself? To make sure that you're working from the same information and understand each other's interpretations, share as specifically as you can recall it what the other person did or said that triggered your reaction. Sydney might say, for example, when you stroked my hair or asked if we could spend some private time at the beach, I was confused about what you wanted from our relationship, and I began to worry that if you wanted romance, then I would have a real problem on my hands. In addition to explaining what triggered your reaction, you should be prepared to say what you would have them do differently in the future, and explain how this would help you behave differently as well. Making a specific request for how the other person can change their contribution in the service of helping you change yours can be a powerful way of helping them understand what they are doing to create and perpetuate the problem. And it goes to the heart of the purpose of understanding the contribution system, to see what you each need to do differently to influence and improve the situation. Whether you're talking about your contrasting stories, your intentions, or your contributions, the goal isn't to get an admission. The goal is to understand better what's happened between you so that you can talk constructively about where to go next. But in addition to clarifying the what happened conversation, there are two other conversations that need untangling, the feelings and identity conversations.
The feelings conversation. A mother hears a crash in the living room. She runs in and sees her 4-year-old son, baseball bat in hand, standing next to a shattered vase. What happened? She asks. The boy is kind of looking away and he says, nothing. When it comes to acknowledging difficult emotions, we often adopt the strategy of the young batter. If we deny that the emotions are there, then maybe we can avoid the consequences of feeling them. But we have about the same chance of hiding our emotions as the boy has of convincing his mother that all is well with the vase. Feelings are too powerful to remain peacefully bottled. They will be heard one way or another, whether in leaks or in bursts. The failure to acknowledge and discuss feelings derails an incredible number of difficult conversations, and the inability to deal openly and well with feelings can undermine the quality and the health of our relationships. Max and his daughter Julie are negotiating about how much to spend on Julie's upcoming wedding. Should this conversation be about money alone? If so, then Max and Julie can simply list what they want and look for ways to accommodate these desires. That's it, says Max. We'll spend $2,000 on the ballroom, $1,500 on the band, $7,200 on the food. End of conversation. But it's not that easy. The conversation feels difficult and stressful for both dad and daughter. Each is feeling impatient, a little bit sensitive, and ready to find fault with the other. It is not, after all, just a matter of money. It's also about feelings. Max, for example, experiences a range of feelings when he thinks of the event. He feels sadness, he feels joy. Sadness because he'll be receiving less of Julie's attention from now on, Joy, because she's matured into such a wonderful woman. To Max, the planning of the event represents a final opportunity for his daughter to be